Welcome to Fish Talk Radio. I'm John Hennigan in studio with our very special guest. We have Chris Goldblatt. Now, Chris is an author, and I'm looking at what happened to those books. There we go. He's written a series of books.
Here's all 10 of them.
That I haven't had a chance to read them yet, but they've been highly recommended. So the one you've got, the first I'm looking at is Fishing for Success, and I understand that how you apply what you learn in fishing to the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's amazing what you learn on the water. You know, I spent, you know, the better part of the last 30 years on and under the water. And and when I got done being a professional fisherman, I went into the business world. And, you know, the college education was nice up there at Humboldt. But really what I use on day to day is what I learn fishing. You know, I mean, you know, fishing has its cost of benefit analysis. There's a lot of risk and reward involved. And it applies to business, you know, and every time I make a mistake in business, I go back and I go, gee whiz, I didn't follow the suggestions
right.
of my own book.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So now, and there is, there's a lot of analogies, things that, you know, I'm not as involved as you are, but there's certain things that are universal. It's like, you know, when you're fishing, you want to go where the fish are.
Okay? That's right.
So when you're in business, you know, that's not a bad thing to remember. And then things, you know, similar to that is, you know, first of all, they always say that if you don't catch any fish, if your line's not in the water.
That's true. And you got to use the right bait. I mean, there's analogies on and on. And how to stick to the code group, you know, people that you build a close alliance with and you stick with them, you know, exploit the opportunities closest to home first. You know, things like that. And they cross
over. Well, let's just start off with just a real brief history. I know that you're not the kind of person that talks about yourself, but give us just a real quick summary as to where you started and why you're sitting here now.
Well, you know, I started by, I speared my first fish when I was 6 years old, where I grew up down in Paradise Cove in Malibu, and became a pinhead working on the boats out of Malibu when I was 10. And then went to work in the San Diego fleet when I was 12, although I think they thought I was 14, something like that. And then just had a nice long career in sport and commercial fishing up and down the coast and points beyond, imported, exported seafood and things like that. And then I majored in fisheries and business up there at Humboldt. And when I got out, I decided to look at other things. While I was at Humboldt State, I pioneered what is now the sustainable seafood movement. And that has become a whole thing in and of itself. And that was sort of the beginning of my conservation career. And that's led towards bigger projects like the Fish Reef Project, where, you know, we're a nonprofit that creates reefs to enhance and maintain and conserve our marine ecosystem.
Well, I know that you're a pioneer in the sustainable seafood movement, but you're also founder of the Fish Reef Projects. And then, of course, the easy way to find out about that is a real, real simple. We don't like to give phone numbers and websites because people never remember, but this one they'll remember. It's fishreef.org.
That's right. Not fisheries, but fishreef.org. That's right.
So that's a real simple one. If you're sitting at a computer while you're listening, well, of course, if you're listening while at the computer, well, I'm going to get a headache over that. But anyway, check that out, and you'll learn a little bit more about what he's doing. And the Fish Reef Project. What is the mission and the purpose?
It's to restore and enhance the marine ecosystem using mainly artificial reefs as the way to do that, and using very special material. We mainly focus on something called reef balls, which are underwater igloo shaped objects with holes in them. They're originally similar materials were pioneered in Japan in the 1960s, where they have over 100,000 reefs in Japan at this point, and really robust domestic fish stocks as a result.
Because Japan, you know, for how many centuries, eons, has been relying on fish. And, you know, when you fish that much to feed your people, that's kind of depletes the fisheries. So I'd imagine they'd be very interested.
Yeah, they've really perfected it. They in Japan's really interesting. They make reefs the size of apartment buildings down there where on the bottom you have the small fish, and then they kind of move up in apartment buildings till you have the big groupers sitting on the top. But mostly they settled on objects like what we use that are the most productive.
Well, what you brought into the studio is a miniature version of the Igloo, yeah, that's probably the best way to call it. It's kind of shaped like a top of a bell, but it has holes in it to the top and all the way around the side. And the material itself is a little bit interesting. It's a type of concrete. Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a marine concrete. The actual thing has aggregate on it, little pebbles, to increase the surface area.
Mm-hmm.
The key to a successful reef is two things. Is what the scientists called interstitial area, which is the cave area on the inside. That's really the compounding factor to making a really robust reef system, is how much cave area you have, combined with a vertical lift. So you need that vertical lift, because a lot of reefs have been made out of flat material. So mm-hmm. a lot of seaweed likes to grow on flat material. If you have vertical material, you usually have corals and gargonians that take it over. So the reef ball is a balance between the two, because it's a nice gentle slope. So you get kelp growth on it, and then you get those juvenile fish in there. We put two out here off of Santa Barbara in June of 2012, and amazing fish life. The Sebastes, where they're the rock fish, seven of them, including Boccaccio, the imperiled salmon grouper, basically.
Which are endangered.
Well, it's a recovering species. Mm-hmm. We got vermilion, what we call red snapper. Mm-hmm. And a number of different species. We got 70 rock scallops, 7-0 on two reef balls.
Wow.
And the rock scallops are neat because they clean the water. They're filter feeders. So you actually can scrub the water with these things.
And the kelp that comes up kind of does the same thing too, doesn't it?
It does. It captures a lot of the turbidity, the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
It'll grab the dirt. So where you have the reefs, you tend to have cleaner water. And you also tend to have lower acid levels. You can actually buffer locally the acidification issues within an artificial reef system.
So what acidification means, the acid in the water?
Yeah, that's a growing concern, because mm-hmm. the locked up carbon dioxide in the ocean can increase acid levels, and that makes it hard for things with calcium-based shells to grow. So things like scallops and oysters and clams have difficulty growing and higher acid levels, and we can buffer that, mm-hmm. basically.
Well, I'm looking at the sample that you gave me, and there's an enclosure inside, and I know that, you know, from what I know about fishing, is that when you're looking for fish, what you want to do is look for structure, whether it's a seamount that comes up only a couple hundred feet below sea level, or if it's rocks, or when you're bass fishing, you know, you're always looking for the weeds. And what this does, apparently, by, you know, having the structure, the larger predators can't get inside.
Well, I mean, by larger predators, you mean marine
big sharks,
marine mammals,
yeah,
or sharks.
That's true. Yeah.
What it does, it allows more juvenile fish to
have a safe haven.
Have a safe haven and become fish of breeding size.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an amplifier effect. But if you go all the way down to the microscopic level, down to the planktonic mm-hmm. level, mm-hmm. hard bottom is a limiting factor to marine life. So plankton drifts along, and mm-hmm. if it doesn't find hard bottom, it dies. It becomes what you call detritus. So by just putting a little bit more hard bottom, you allow more plankton to settle and grow and become plants and animals. Mm-hmm. And it's the beginning of the food chain. And then once they essentially hatch, then there's a place for them to hide and escape predation and grow into fish that can then spawn.
This seems like such a no-brainer, there's a lot of people that don't believe this is the best way to manage our fisheries. So, you know, what we'd like to do, maybe cover in the next segment, mm-hmm. about is to what are the downsides, or, you know, the pitfalls, or, you know, what's the negative, if there is one, to creating artificial reefs, because it has not been widely accepted by all of our, say, environmentalist community.
I think that you'll find that there's 500,000 of these reef balls around the world, and there's heavy, heavy science and support that there's a net positive production as far as biomass,
mm-hmm.
as far as corals and kelp and things like that. The only question is on fish themselves. And there's really good studies that have come out of our local school, UCSB, mm-hmm. where they've looked at exactly that, and the indications are that there is a net positive.
Well, now we're gonna find out. As a matter of fact, we're really going to find out, because we have a good friend of mine, a great guy, that we're going to bring on as soon as we come back from the break. And this is Carl Vicente, that resides in Hawaii. And he used to have a dive shop, and he's very involved in this. So we're going to find out from him as soon as we get back. You are listening to Fish Talk Radio. Be right back with you.
But I wish that I was fishing. S-A-N-D-O-S is how to spell luxury resort in downtown Cabo San Lucas. Sandos Finisterra Los Cabos is the only five-star all-inclusive on the beach next to the marina in Cabo San Lucas. Angler-friendly Sandos Finisterra Los Cabos is now an affordable world-class resort with the finest accommodations, food, and location anywhere. Enjoy your Cabo fishing adventure as you never have. Visit Sandos.com and use discount code FISHTALK.
World-class golf, fishing, and diving in the clear, warm waters of the Sea of Cortez with a true five-star resort. The Grand Heritage Hotel and Resort at Costa Baja, great value and without the hustle of other parts of Baja. On the white sand beach with Espiritu Santos Island minutes away. Signature restaurants, pools, and accommodations for an intimate weekend, weddings, or corporate events. On the web at CostaBajaResort.com.
The road stretches for miles in front of you. And with the Ram 1500, you'll be able to reach mile after open mile. It gets a best-in-class 25 miles per gallon highway, so your destination won't just be determined by your gas gauge, but by your gauge for achievement. And the Ram 1500 is the first ever back-to-back Motor Trend Truck of the Year. Guts. Glory. Ram. See your local Ram dealer today for great deals. EPA estimated 25 mpg highway based on V6 4x2.
It's time for you to take a real fun adventure. Join a hosted fishing adventure to Alaska or Baja with the staff of Fish Talk Radio. Real Fun Adventures can book you on any adventure you desire. Bring your fishing friends or meet new ones. Fish Talk Radio gets the best deals from our sponsors to give you the best possible price. Real Fun Trips are inclusive, easy, no-worry packages to the most popular fish grounds. Trips start around $600. Go to reelfunadventures.com.
The Santa Barbara Channel offers some of the most productive sport fishing in the world. Channel Island Sport Fishing offers the most boats to enjoy it. Call 805-382-1612. At Channel Island Sport Fishing, you pick the time and place you want to go. Nearshore halibut, calico bass, and rockfish, or fish the Channel Islands for white sea bass and yellowtail. For whale watching and private charters, Channel Island Sport Fishing in Oxnard has clean, modern boats with professional, friendly crews. Make your reservations for a deep sea adventure by calling 805-382-1612.
Vagabundos del Mar Boat and Travel Club has 42 years experience introducing RVers to the joys of Mexico. Specializing in Baja, Vagabundos leads caravans and sponsors fishing tournaments, trailer boat cruises, and weekend getaways in Mexico and the West. Vagabundos del Mar also saves its 10,000 members tons of money on low-cost auto insurance. Stay up to date on Mexican travel with the printed newsletter online at vagabundos.com or call 800-474-BAJA.
There in the water, look at it shine. There goes a big one, that one of mine.
Welcome to Cork and Fork Radio. I'm in the studio with John Hennigan. I am John Hennigan. And I'm in the studio with Chris Goldblatt. And we also have a very special guest that is with us today from Hawaii, I believe on the island of Oahu, Carl Vicente, is also very much involved in what we're talking about. And we're going to bring Carl in just a minute, and we're going to get Chris a chance to kind of better explain what it is that you're putting together. You've already got some success, but what you're looking to do is take it on a larger scale, and of course, money is a big part of it.
It is. I mean, the state of California and the state of Hawaii, they technically have reefing programs, but they're more or less non-functional. The rest of the states in the union, including the seaside states, including the Great Lakes, have robust reef-making programs because they acknowledge the fact that there's a net positive in terms of fisheries and biomass and cleaning the environment and offsetting human impacts. And there's a federal fishing tax on every hook and sinker that you buy that goes to the federal government. They dole it back to the state fisheries agencies, and then those fisheries agencies spend it on making artificial reefs. California gets that money, but they do other things with it. I don't know exactly what they do with it, but they don't make reefs.
It kind of disappears into a black hole. Is that what you're saying?
It does. I'm being nice there. So to back up to 1957, they made the first artificial reef off where I grew up in Paradise Cove out of Studebakers. Mm-hmm. It lasted 7 years. They counted 22,000 fish on it, and then they rotted out. And then there was a big wave of making reefs out of quarry rock in the 1980s where Department of Fish and Game made 80 beautiful Cory Rock reefs, which are there. If you look at our website, fishreef.org, we've begun sort of an anthology where we film each one of these because there's no studies, there's no science, or very little, to where even the government agencies don't even know how these reefs are performing. So we're providing that service to the public so they can people can see, hey, man, this is something really valuable. We need more of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we mentioned, there are some people, and I think that there's some people that are probably consider themselves environmentalists that don't believe that artificial reefs actually work in creating new fish. They say that they attract fish, but that doesn't mean they really help overall population. But let's go ahead and bring Carl in on this subject, and maybe the both of you can talk about that a little bit. Carl, have you found that type of resistance in Hawaii?
Very minimal, and the significance in Hawaii as to other states is there's no program that's structured to have a program for benefiting, you know, artificial reefing. And that's where things need to be brought to the next level. I mean, a lot of people get it. The benefits of artificial reefing impact a state like Hawaii dramatically. It helps fisheries. It helps science research. It involves all the educational institutions and marine sciences programs. It helps with the conservation and development of topography and resources that we have. The coastal coral reefs in Hawaii are a bit different. They're a volcanic state. So the reefs are unique in that sense. And then there is a lot of barren topography here. And that's where artificial reefing can help.
Well,
it can help develop indigenous fish from our state perspective, and it can help with fisheries. And all of those programs are highly beneficial. But more so, John, it impacts every aspect of the vital community that we have. It impacts the business, and therefore you can create more businesses and all different aspects of what reefing does. It could present more snorkeling sites, more diving sites, more fishing sites.
That's very true.
Don't have to be conservation districts, perhaps, but it can be inclusive of every aspect of our community. The other thing it does in a state like Hawaii, it could be a very valuable attraction in that the $80 million that are spent on direct travel from a dive perspective for people to go to places like Mexico, Cozumel, those type of destinations, we don't have that drive here because we don't have enough of the coastal inshore reefing and development, and therefore we get overused at management sites like Hanama Bay, and then we're very restricted because the 405 different species of fish that reside here in our beautiful state are not cultivated and they're not cared for in such a way where artificial reefs would provide habitat, research, science, education, all the benefits to everybody. And what I mean by that as well from a business perspective, more people traveling on our airlines, more people staying at our hotels, more people here spending money for food and beverage.
If I could just interject, Carl, about I've been told by my friends over in Hawaii that one of the Hawaiian words for fisherman is steward, right? That historically the fishermen were the stewards of the resource. And I think it's very important that as a group of people that we consider ourselves stewards of the resource and be leaders and not followers and reactionaries. And this is a way to lead the movement. And, you know, historically the Hawaiians got that. And I think that the fishing community at large, I can reference, say, you know, the duck hunters. If there were no duck hunters, there'd be no ducks. And in California, the fishermen are almost solely responsible for the recovery of the white sea bass here. So that's the strongest example I can give. When I was a kid, white sea bass were very far and few between, and they recovered. So we can really set this precedent that we're the ones taking charge, because the reality is we're closest to the resource in a lot of ways. We see it on a regular basis. We see it, we feel it, we breathe it, we live it. If you look at the ocean as sort of the collective immune system of the planet, mm-hmm. If you make that immune system as strong as possible, then everything is healthier. And if you look at the reef balls as sort of vitamins within that immune system, you really boost the whole thing up. But I want to speak just to one second about, this question rears its head over and over again, so I might as well get to it. The attraction versus production question. Does it attract or produce? There's no question that the benthic animals, the corals, the kelp, the scallops, it's net production. It creates more, absolutely. And the science is leaning towards, yes, that there's a net production on fish. But I need to qualify that by saying that the reef has to be large enough to be a net production unit. It has to feed itself. If you throw one reef ball down there, yes, it is an attractant. If you throw 2,000 of them down there, now you've created a self-sustaining ecosystem.
Nursery. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a nursery of types. And so the question really is, if you put reefs in the water, regardless of attraction versus production or regardless of fishing pressure, will you have more life? And the answer unequivocally is yes. And anybody who doubts that just doesn't spend time in the water. They just don't go down and look at what reefs do. I've been looking at artificial reefs since I was 12 years old. I know what they do. Millions of people around the world know what they do. There really is no question. If there's opposition, it generally comes from a place of ignorance. A lot of the groups that I've talked to—
I didn't say that.
Yeah. A lot of the groups that I've talked to that might have originally opposed, by the time they've seen what we've done and what we can do, they'll support it. I've even talked in front of groups like Surfrider, and they came out and, individuals in there came out in support of it. So opposition is almost negligent or negligible, mm-hmm. almost not even there.
Mm-hmm. So the science is part of the problem is there's not a lot of science that's verifiable. But what you're doing and the success that you had, that is verifiable.
Well, it is. Yeah. Well, no, there's major studies that have occurred. Here at UCSB, I'd like to point out one example. In front of the San Onofre nuclear power plant, Southern California Edison made a 174-acre reef that came online 10 years ago. And the studies from UCSB have shown that reef attracts and produces at least as well as a natural reef. They haven't gone so far as to say, yes, there's more net fish production. I know that studies have been done on some of the oil rigs that do say that there is likely a net fish production or some slightly blurry language. They always stop just short of it because, mm-hmm. That's what they do.
Well, this is a quick thought, Carl. We've only got about a minute left, but I just want to make one quick comment. There's a push for marine sanctuaries for no fishing zones. And I think it's very coincidental that the areas that they want to close off are all where the reefs are. What a coincidence. But if they don't think reefs work, then why are they trying to protect that?
That's a very good point.
Real quick, if I may, here's the point that you're making. And I understand what they're trying to do from a preservation perspective, but we're conservationists at heart. And here's what we're trying to do. And if we have an inclusive message and we talk to everybody about all the beneficial factors in reefing and artificial reefing, then we will have nobody standing in opposition. I can guarantee that. Mm-hmm. It's the lack of information and communication throughout the entire spectrum of the community, from the neighborhood board through the fire departments and rescue departments and coast guards and shipping lanes and matches, as Chris brought up. But everybody, it has to be an inclusive process, mm-hmm. and you'll find that these people grab onto this,
right.
and they'll love it.
Well, Carl, we're going to keep you around if you don't mind. We're going to have to go to a break here in about 30 seconds. But I think when I come back, I want to ask the question about topography and where reefs work and where they may not work. So if you can, I'd like you to stick around for a while. We really enjoy having you, and just a great subject that I think more people need to learn a lot more about. And, of course, you are listening to fishtalkradio.com. Go to our Facebook, and you can learn about some of the guests that are on the show today. We'll be right back.
I'm John Hennigan, host of Fish Talk Radio. This is Common Sense Conservation, brought to you by Santa Monica Seafood. We are talking to Captain Sig Hansen. Captain Sig, give us a real quick idea about sustainable fishing that you're involved with.
Well, as far as sustainability, I think Alaska has really set the bar. We took 40 to 45% of the male crab off the ground, and these days we take 15, and I've still seen swings both ways, both up and down, as far as these stocks are concerned. As far as sustainability, it's all about the ecosystem, and the reality is, you know, especially for the crab population, there's so much predation that that's really what affects these swings in population. You've got a lot of predators. You've got a lot of cod and halibut and the yellowfin sole. Right. And so you've got these large swings.
Is this by regulation or are the fishermen actually aware of this?
I think the fishermen are aware of it. But as far as regulatory, you know, the scientists just go by what they see. But, you know, there's always a reason for the madness, and they don't always want to see the reason behind the madness. They
right.
just look at the numbers
okay.
of what they see in front of them there. But for me, I look at the past. Why did this swing happen? It's very obvious, but it's just they can't always prove
okay.
it.
Well,
but for me, it's common sense. I know why.
There you go. Thank you, Captain Sig Hansen. This is Common Sense Conservation, brought to you by Santa Monica Seafood. Santa Monica Seafoods works for sustainable fisheries. If you have someone who wants fishing tackle for Christmas, we have a present for you. Just send me an email to john@fishtalkradio.com and ask for it. Lunker Box has a limited amount of gift boxes of fishing tackle to give to our listeners. The value is $50 to $100. There's no tax, no shipping. It is a gift to you. Just send me an email as soon as possible to get yours. Send email to john@fishtalkradio.com. If you want to give yourself a present, let me know what kind of fishing trip you would like. I will find the right place at the right price. Working with our sponsors, we can arrange some incredible trips to Baja at extremely discounted prices. Just send me an email, get your gift, and let me know what you're interested in. Please do not wait until they are gone. Email john@fishtalkradio.com.
I wish that I was fishing.
Welcome back to Fish Talk Radio. I'm John Hennigan in studio with a couple of very special guests. And again, today we're doing something we have never done before, but it's so important and so fascinating. That's what we're doing for the entire program. And I would like to call it a situation of win, win, win. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that. Carl from Hawaii, and we have Chris in here. A quick question that I have. What about topography? Can you put a reef anywhere, or is there some places it's more effective or some places it's not going to work?
Well, nature certainly doesn't care where it puts a reef. So high relief structure just shows up at fault lines and boulders fall in the water. So the natural way is just that it's just kind of a random event. When humans put something down, there's a lot to consider. You asked earlier the question of where does it work best. Well, the term work depends on what you want out of it. If you put it in a dead zone and it just makes a little bit more life and it's not super fishy, well, there's still more life than there was there before. If you want the maximum benefit, you put it in areas that are near a drop-off with high current, somewhere where you've done a study to show that you're going to get good recruitment and production mm-hmm. of things. And then there's the fundamental things like you want to keep them away from pipelines and oil derricks, and you want to make sure it's not a navigational hazard. You want to make sure it's not near a surf break, kind of the pragmatic aspects of mm-hmm. it.
Well, Carl, Hawaii, most of the coastline length along there drops off pretty quickly, doesn't it? Well, there he is. Carl.
Sorry.
You went to a quick, luau there.
You're running your business. The question was, the coastline of Hawaii, most of it drops off very quickly because they're basically their mountains. Is that right?
That's correct. But we have a nice stretch out there that gradually mm-hmm. drops off, and then we got some real quick drop-offs right outside of Pearl Harbor to drop down to 6,000 feet.
Whoa. Oh, that's right. So we're talking about placement of reefs, and where's a good place to put them?
Well, there's a number of places not to put them, and that's where the consideration comes in for all the other users. And it's not just the big users that we're talking about in shipping lanes or, you know, safety, but we're talking about, you know, the surfers, the fishermen, the swimmers. If you take all of those into consideration and you start dialing it back, you put nice built reefs where it would be most conducive to, you know, our environment here in Hawaii. And then you take into consideration the currents and everything else. And, you know, we have a lot of people that could be involved in that that are really interested in improvement and the development of our fisheries here.
That's true, Carl. And you know, in Hawaii, you need to watch out for putting stuff in sand channels. Otherwise, what you put in 50 feet of water will end up in 2,000 feet of water and slide down. You got to watch out for that for that kind of thing.
Well, let's go back a little bit to the project that Chris is working on, and I've got sitting in front of me. I can think of a lot of different things. He calls it like an igloo, and I'd say that's probably what it looks like. It's got holes in it, a hole on the top. And the one that I've got is a miniature size, but what size are the ones you put in the water?
Oh, they come in a number of different sizes, and it's a technology that's patented by a firm in Florida called the Reef Ball Foundation, and they essentially advise us and provide contractors and material support. They go all the way from a foot tall all the way to 6 feet tall and 6,000 pounds, and they have fancy names like Goliath Ball and Ball and things like that.
Right.
And the chemistry of it's really important because you have to make it the right pH to where it's a marine cement and it attracts versus repels life. And that is particularly important in Hawaii with the corals. And unfortunately, the Hawaiian Reefing Program has used what they call comeback cement, which is cement left at the end of the day at a construction site. It tends to be really caustic and hot, so you don't get too much coral growth on it. So that's one of the reasons why we want to help out the agencies in Hawaii and help them with structures that they're going to get much better coral growth on it than what
Chris,
they're currently using.
Could you kind of give an overview of what a reef would look like that you would like to put out?
Sure. I mean, as I mentioned before, nature doesn't care. Nature's into randomness. In California, it's a little bit more important to us that we have a reef that's in a hub and spoke type situation. So we have a big central mass that acts like a city. That's where everything grows. A lot of things can hide. There's a lot of areas where no diver can get to in the middle of it. So there are certain areas that are essentially protected in the middle of it. And then there's big branches coming off of this. And the reason we chose that is because the kelp will grow on it, as we've proven through our 19-month pilot project. The kelp will grow on the reef balls. But it'll grow in a hub-and-spoke fashion, so you get a lot of edges. And fish love edges, especially breeding fish will use those edges. So we call it like an amplifier effect. Instead of having a four-acre reef, we're going to have a reef that maybe operates more like a 15-acre reef as far as its life-holding capacity. And the other thing is light penetration. The San Onofre reef, the 170-acre reef, wasn't made by fishermen, and it was made by a bunch of little tiny flat quarry rocks. So they got giant amount of kelp, but it did tend to choke out the light. And the understory, the things that grow underneath it, didn't quite thrive the way that they had hoped. And then, of course, there's dead zones in the middle to where you don't have a lot of fish thriving in the middle of this mat. Mm-hmm. The way we're constructing our reef, you're going to get adequate light penetration. So everything from the top up is going to get sort of its maximum amount of sunlight, maximum amount of edges for fish to come in and spawn, and then sand in the middle for the flat fish. So you have a more of a complex marine ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carl enjoys fishing, but his true passion, I think, is scuba diving. Mm-hmm. So, Carl, how does this fit in with what you envision?
Well, you know, snorkeling and scuba diving and enjoying the water, man, it's great for everybody. And this is perfect. You know, artificial reefing and every aspect of it is only going to help develop, you know, the fisheries and the reefs that we have out there now, and strategic placement is key, as we all know. And I think Chris is spot on with coming and meeting with the right people and having the right conversations. And you would think that California and Hawaii would be the drivers. We have, you know, New Jersey, the state of New Jersey, that has more artificial reefs probably than any state in the union.
That's absolutely true. California is supposed to be an environmental and conservation leader. And there, in, at least from my purview, there is no better way to stimulate the marine ecosystem into being healthy and making up for human impacts, making up for fishing impacts, making up for dirty water runoff, which is a horrible, terrible problem in both California and Hawaii. Mm-hmm. We have to clean the water. We should be at the absolute precipice, the absolute forefront. And currently, there is no state-sponsored reefing program in California and a limited one in Hawaii, and where all there is.
I'm a little curious. The question is, because water pollution and some of the heavy metals and all the agricultural runoff and the acidification that you talked about in the water, how does a reef help with that?
Well, when it comes to acidification, Scripps Institute of Oceanography tells us that within the kelp ecosystem itself, you have lower amounts of acid, and that comes from increased fish feces that actually buffer it.
Okay.
And then, thanks to the fish poop, right?
Yeah.
And then the reef balls themselves sequester the acid because of the way the pH is set up. They're like giant rollades on the bottom of the seafloor. So we can create a haven within the kelp forest that maybe has a slightly lower acid level. So if acidification becomes a real runaway issue, there could be havens for essentially the mollusks and the crabs to be able to form shells, which is what acid does. It prevents shell formation.
Wow, this is interesting stuff.
You know, if I may, a lot of the problems we have with runoff in California and Hawaii are the artificial aqueducts that were put into place, and therefore you have no filtration as water comes from the mountain to the oceans. So, you know, I think, you know, if you expand the reefing programs and you look at the aqueduct systems and you do something there as well, that would limit some of, it's another subject matter, but it's the same subject matter as you're talking about when you're talking about filtration.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Carl, we've only got about 2 minutes left. But when you have a kelp forest, it's a plant. So just like any forest, you know, the forests help filter the air, and they take in oxygen and put out carbon dioxide that we need, and they, you know, there's a lot of good things. So the kelp itself, does that have something to do with it?
It does. Well, the kelp will sequester carbon dioxide, not a vast amount, but it will. I mean, if the whole world was covered in kelp, you would have a lot less carbon dioxide, certainly out there. The dynamic is different on coral reefs. Of course, but the more reef structure you have, the more coral you have, so the more you can offset the impacts of coral bleaching and the crown of thorns, which is this carnivorous sea star that eats all the coral.
Well, before we run out of time, which is coming up quickly, we'll mention one more time. There's a website that even a dummy like me can probably remember after I walk away from here, and that is Fish Reef, right? Fishreef.org.
Fishreef.org, and you can go there and see all the videos of everything we've done and all of our supporters, and there are many.
Mm-hmm. And Carl, you've been a great supporter on that also. If you want to give a plug to somebody, you're more than welcome to. I know that you're involved in a lot of different things over there.
Well, DEMA.org is involved, and I'm sure they'd be glad to help out.
Can you spell that?
A program like Chris's. DEMA.org.
Okay.
DEMA.org. Mm-hmm. They're a good organization, and they're for everything healthy with our environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, I think that we've learned that the people that use the water know more about it than maybe some of the people that study the water. And it's, you know, what you're talking about is it's all natural. I mean, that's the way things used to be before, you know, things got overfished.
Look, reefing is a normal human endeavor. It goes back to the time of the Egyptians. The Egyptians made reefs.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, this is very, very exciting stuff. Carl, we really appreciate you coming on. And then, of course, Chris. And I think that we might see if we can get you guys together real quick. But right now, we're going to have to end this segment. It is fishtalkradio.com. Go to Fish Talk Radio Facebook, and there you can learn more about today's program. We appreciate that. We'll be talking to you soon.